Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Vicor earnings results for the second quarter ended June 30th, 2015 conference call. My name is Tia, and I'll be your operator for today. At this time, all participants are in listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. If at any time you need operator assistance, press star zero, and a coordinator will be happy to assist you. I would now like to turn the conference over to your host for today, Dr. Fabrizio Vincenzali, CEO, and James Simms, CFO. Please proceed.
Thank you, operator. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Vicor's conference call for the second quarter ended June 30th, 2015. I'm James Simms, CFO, and with me here in Andover are Patrizio Vinciarelli, Chief Executive Officer, and Dick Nagel, Chief Accounting Officer. Today, we issued a press release summarizing our financial results for the second quarter and six months ended June 30th. The press release is available on the investor relations page of our website, vicorpower.com. We've also filed a Form 8-K with the SEC in association with issuing this press release. I remind listeners this conference call is being recorded and is the copyrighted property of Vicor Corporation. I also remind you various remarks we may make during this call may constitute forward-looking statements for purposes of the safe harbor provisions under the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act of 1995. Our forward-looking statements are subject to risks and uncertainties that may cause actual results to differ materially from those explicitly set forth or implied in our statements. Such risks and uncertainties are discussed in our most recent Form 10-K filed with the SEC on March 6th, 2015. Please note the information provided during this conference call is accurate only as of today, Tuesday, July 28th, 2015. Vicor undertakes no obligation to update any statements made during this call, and you should not rely upon such statements after the conclusion of the call. A replay of today's call will be available beginning at midnight tonight through August 12th, 2015. The replay dial-in number is 888-286-8010, and the passcode is 31503478. In addition, a webcast replay of today's call will be available shortly on the investor relations page of our website. I should also point out the audio recording from the annual shareholders meeting, which took place on June 19th, has yet to be posted on our website, as has been our practice. As those who attended the shareholders meeting are aware, the service provider experienced technical difficulties with the recording, and we continue to work towards recovering a usable version that we could post on the website. We appreciate shareholders' patience with this process. I will start this afternoon's discussion with a review of our financial performance for the quarter, and Patrizio will follow with his comments, after which he will take your questions regarding our business. As set forth in this afternoon's press release, Vicor recorded earnings of $0.02 per share, representing a net profit for the second quarter of $805,000 on revenue of $56.1 million. For the preceding quarter, we recorded earnings of $0.09 per share, representing a net profit of $3.4 million on revenue of just over $64 million. In contrast, for the second quarter of 2014, a year ago, we recorded a net loss of $0.13 per share, representing a net loss of $4.8 million on revenue of $53.4 million. Quarterly revenue declined approximately 12% sequentially, but was 5.2% ahead of the second quarter of 2014. Revenue recorded by the brick business unit was up slightly sequentially, while VI-Chip and Picor experienced sequential revenue declines of 41% and 52% respectively, reflecting their vulnerability to customer concentration during this early phase of their development and market penetration with new products. Vicor's second quarter performance reflects the circumstances described during our February and April earnings call, as the pull-in of shipments from Q2 into Q1 of our Generation 3 chip VTM SIP PRM solution for data center servers and a delayed transition from the current voltage regulation standard, VR12.5, to Intel's next generation standard, VR13, has caused a temporary reduction in revenues and bookings. Patrizio will address this topic when he begins his remarks in a moment. International revenue, based on the location of the party to which we ship, fell to 57.6% of total revenue for the second quarter from 64.7% for the first quarter, reflecting the decline of VI-Chip and PICOR shipments to Asian contract manufacturers. Concluding on consolidated revenue, recognized distribution revenue for Q2 rebounded 23.4% after a weak Q1. Our efforts to expand our volumes through stocking distribution continue, as evidenced by our announcement on July 14th of a global distribution agreement with Mouser Electronics. Consolidated gross profit as a percentage of sales increased from 45.1% for Q1 to 47.2% for Q2, despite lower revenue driven by mix and utilization. This is our highest consolidated gross margin since Q3 of 2010 and, in part, is attributable to the efficiencies we're realizing due to the full consolidation of Westcor manufacturing into our Andover operation. Besides the benefits of improved utilization, we also are benefiting from a narrowed Westcor product line, which is now focused on higher value-add opportunities. I also want to highlight the manufacturing achievements of VI Chip, which, not so long ago, would have experienced a pronounced decline in its gross margin with a drop in production like the one we experienced during the second quarter. However, I am pleased to report VI Chip's gross margin for the quarter was only off approximately 2 points due to an understandably lower overhead absorption. Our factory processes are reaching maturity, and average unit costs and yields, as well as ASPs, continue their steady improvement. VI Chip gross margins are not yet at the level we're targeting, in line or in excess of our traditional bricks, but they are getting closer, and sustained high production volumes we're planning for 2016 should drive average costs even lower. Consolidated operating income declined largely due to the revenue decline, as total operating expenses for the quarter increased only 1.7% sequentially, with the uptick largely associated with compensation increases associated with our annual performance review cycle, which occurs during the second quarter. Total G&A expenses were lower by 7% due to a seasonal decline in audit and reporting charges, as well as lower legal fees. R&D expenses for the quarter were steady, rising only slightly. Sales and marketing expenses rose 6.7%, largely attributable to higher advertising and marketing expenses in Q2 associated with our new product rollout, as well as higher sales commissions for the quarter related to the higher mix of products sold for which we pay sales commissions. While up sequentially, sales and marketing expenses for the first 6 months of 2015 were slightly lower than the first 6 months of 2016, despite higher headcount. Our quarterly consolidated income tax provision was straightforward. For Q2, our effective tax rate was 7.3%, largely reflecting state income taxes and international taxes. For Q1, our effective tax rate was 3.9%. Turning to cash flow for Q2, operations generated $7.2 million, up from the prior quarter's $5.1 million. Working capital, here defined as current assets net of cash and changes in reserves and non-cash foreign exchange translation, less current liabilities, declined $3.7 million, representing a source of cash as accounts receivable declined with Q1 invoice payments. Inventories remained at appropriate levels while current liabilities declined slightly. Capital expenditures for the quarter rose slightly to $1.8 million from $1.5 million for the prior quarter, in line with recent trends. While I'm not prepared to provide details regarding costs or timing, I am pleased to disclose we have initiated two meaningful initiatives to repurpose and/or retrofit space in our Andover manufacturing facility. These initiatives are intended to create streamlined operating capacity, primarily for the manufacture of DIA systems, using currently underutilized space. Turning to our consolidated balance sheet, the quality of our receivables portfolio remains excellent, with day sales steady at 42 days. Annualized turnover of consolidated inventories remained high at 5.1 times. There were no meaningful changes to AR, inventory, warranty, or other reserves. Cash and cash equivalents stood at $65.2 million at quarter end, up from the prior quarter's $59.4 million. This figure includes one last auction rate security with a par value of $3 million, carried on our balance sheet at an estimated fair value of $2.6 million, representing roughly 87% of par value.
Did you mean to say excludes?
Did I say excludes?
You said include.
Oh, sorry. Employee headcount as of June 30th was 1,031, down 2 from March 31st figure of 1,033. I'll now turn to the performance of our business units. As stated earlier, the brick business unit as a whole reported a 1.3% sequential increase in revenue after a 4% sequential decline in revenue for the first quarter. We did not see a pronounced shift in our mix of brick, configurable, and custom system revenue quarter to quarter, as the performance of certain market segments and geographies offset one another. However, BBU bookings declined 12% for the second quarter, with pockets of weakness throughout North America, Europe, and Asia. The book-to-bill ratio for the BBU declined to approximately 0.9 to 1. As discussed before, we look at bookings trends for the BBU, which serves a diverse customer base with a wide range of products using a mass customization model, over many quarters. Despite what we see in the news regarding various countries' economies, we do not see any worrisome trends. The global economic recovery is neither robust nor uniform, and certain market segments and regions appear to be experiencing some degree of uncertainty. As with revenue, bookings from BBU customers in certain market segments and geographies offset one another quarter to quarter. However, we are looking to break this pattern for the BBU with our new, highly differentiated VIA front-end system product, with which we intend to drive long-term success and growth opportunities across a diverse set of market segments. The iChip revenue for the second quarter, as stated, decreased 41%, and PICOR revenue declined 52%, reflecting customer concentration in the data center space and the circumstances I described earlier. We continue to ship the current generation of BTM3 and PRM3 solutions for VR12.5 motherboards and expect to do so into 2016. However, due to the pending transition to VR13, we are not seeing the high volume orders for shipment spread across several quarters that had characterized earlier demand. Q2 bookings for VI chip declined 31% to $6.4 million, while PICOR bookings declined 70%, again reflecting these circumstances. We are focused on expanding the universe of early adopters of our factorized power 48-volt architecture, while also diversifying the market segments and applications we serve with our new front-end products. To this end, as Patricio will address further, our new chip modules, either on a standalone basis or in VIA packaging, are gaining traction, as are our SIP point-of-load regulators. Turning to expectations for the third quarter of 2015, we are forecasting a sequential decline in revenue based largely on the booking patterns I've described. Given the mix of our current backlog, we are expecting VI chip and PICOR shipments to decline slightly, while seasonal vacation season softness will impact BBU's turns business. With anticipated lower production, we are not expecting to realize additional volume-related efficiencies. While we do not expect a material change in our operating expenses, including the currently low level of legal fees, the expected decline in revenue likely will cause profitability to decline further. Given our understanding of the second quarter's performance and our expectations for mix in the third quarter, we expect to incur a loss. As I've said before, our operating expense structure is established and capable of supporting much higher sales. So the primary variable impacting quarterly performance going forward will be the amount of revenue we generate in excess of a break-even level. During our Q1 earnings call, I estimated this break-even level to be in the range of $59 million, but I underestimated the leverage of BBU's mass customization model, particularly with turns margin. The progress being made with the integration of Westcore products into the BBU's Andover manufacturing facility, and the ongoing improvement and increasing maturity of VI Chip's manufacturing processes. Based on our second quarter experience, our quarterly break-even level of consolidated revenue for the third quarter should be approximately $56 million. Now I'll turn the call over to Patricia.
Thanks, Jamie. As Jamie addressed, Q2 results largely reflect expectations we communicate to you during recent earnings calls. Since the start of 2015, the timing of Intel processors transitions and a ramp of the F13 solutions for data center applications have been delayed. We now believe our bookings will accelerate as soon as Q4 of this year, with volume shipments occurring starting in mid-year 2016. While Intel has addressed delays in the transition from the Broadwell to the Skylake processor platform, and has set forth a roadmap with the launch of the first chips this quarter, the server-specific chips will not ship in volume until later. Despite the delay, which was not anticipated, the good news is we have the necessary products ready to meet 2016 demand. A silver lining for us is the opportunity to capture, with enhanced VTM PRM solutions, an expanded share of the F13 application. As earlier indicated, Vicor is far better positioned for the transition to the R13 than we were during prior transitions. We have remaining the R12.5 backlog to ship to 2015 and do not have any inventory exposure. We also expect demand for our VR12.5 chipset to extend to at least the first half of 2016, overlapping the ramp for our VR13 design win. Importantly, we are having success with our customer diversification efforts by securing important design wins for our factorized power 48-volt architecture in enterprise performance computing, in addition to data center applications. A growing base of customers are concluding that the use of Vicor's highly differentiated factorized power point-of-load solutions can translate into higher performance at a lower cost for their own products. At a growing rate, the customer's performance objectives can only be met by using our products as components of more dense and efficient power system architecture. Attraction with potential customers across a range of applications continues to accelerate. Sampling of chips, SIP regulators, and via package solutions in PFM, BCM, and DCM configurations accelerated further during the second quarter. Given the length of design cycles, volume POs remain quarters away, but I am pleased with the sustained pace on new product introductions and the enthusiastic response of customers around the world. Last week, we received validation of the enthusiasm for a strategy of differentiated innovation when E Times and EDN magazine awarded to Vicor the ACE Award for a chip DCM family. ACE, which is an acronym for Annual Creativity in Electronics, is an annual award given to companies acknowledged for the innovation leadership in electronics. A DCM was named as an ultimate product in the power category. We're pleased to have been recognized this year among industry leaders, such as Linear Technology, which had won in the power category for the prior 3 years. ACE highlighted the importance of data center energy efficiency when assessing the DCM power family, emphasizing the advantages of high voltage DC distribution that our bus converter modules enable. Chip DCMs provide power density of 5 times greater than competing solutions and supply up to nearly 1.8 kilowatts per module with 98% peak efficiency. A Vicor-enabled high-voltage DC implementation would use BCMs operating from an 80-volt input to supply an isolated 48-volt distribution bus across a server chassis to motherboards utilizing factorized power VTM PRM solutions at their points of load. Such a 380 to 48-volt bus conversion is appropriate for applications in data centers, telecom, and network infrastructure, high-performance instrumentation and tests, and a range of demanding industrial applications. Chip PCMs offered in through-all or surface-mount variants also offer designers considerable flexibility across many applications beyond high voltage distribution. For example, because they may be parallel to provide multi-kilowatt arrays and are capable of bidirectional operation, BCMs can be implemented in battery backup and charging solutions in a hybrid vehicle or in similar renewable energy applications. At PCIM in Europe in May, we announced a VA implementation of the 380 to 48 volt BCM just described. This VIA package includes EMI filtering, transient protection, and rush current limiting, and supports PM bus digital communication. The 9 millimeter thin thermally adapt package is designed for easy chassis mount or board mount, and like the chip DCM it incorporates, it functions bidirectionally and can be powered to provide multi-kilowatt arrays. Important product complements to our HVDC strategy were also announced at PCIM in May. We've expanded our system A package ZVS back regulator family to include 48 volt direct to the point of load step down regulators at unparalleled power density and efficiency. With step down regulation from a 48 volt source, designers can deploy more efficient power distribution, reducing distribution resistance and distribution losses, eliminating the need for costly and less efficient intermediate conversion stages. Our ZVS back regulators are designed for a wide range of applications that leverage higher voltage distribution, including current control for LED lighting applications. Another product announcement during the quarter is the first VIA PFM AC-DC front-end module. This slick converter module achieve unmatched power density, supplying an isolated, PFC-regulated 24 or 48 volt DC output from an AC input range of 85 to 264 volts. The VIA PFM is 5 times thinner than traditional 1U power supplies, offering compelling advantages to designers challenged by size constraints. With its 9mm thin profile and 36mm width, the VIA PFM can be mounted on the sidewall of a typical 1U chassis, saving valuable real estate. Thermally adapted VIA PFMs may be conduction cooled to eliminate fans, thereby improving overall system reliability, lowering system cost, and further minimizing the power system footprint. Their high density, high efficiency, and low thermal resistance make VIA PFM front-end modules well-suited for a wide range of applications, including size-constrained LED lighting, industrial robotics, and automation, as well as small cell wireless base station. Recently announced products are evidence Vicor is fulfilling its commitment to providing complete high-performance power system solutions from the AC source or a high-voltage DC source all the way to the point of load. Over the months and quarters to come, we will be rolling out other highly differentiated products, all designed to enable end-to-end implementation of factorized power solutions, providing higher power density, higher efficiency, and market-leading design flexibility. All should contribute to customer, market, and application diversity. However, I again caution listeners regarding the revenue expectations for the new products I just highlighted. Given design and sales cycles, contributions to revenue from recently introduced products will likely not occur until well into 2016. This concludes our prepared remarks, and I will now take your questions.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, press star 1. If your question has been answered or you wish to withdraw your question, press star 2. Questions will be taken in the order received. Again, that is star 1 to begin. The first question comes from the line of Jim Burlett. Please proceed.
Yes, but Jim, could you give us a little more insight, if you can, on the Intel server VR13 rollout? And also, given what's happening in this delay, how would you characterize the milestones that you had previously been thinking that would be achieved in 2016?
Well, I don't know that I can provide any more insight than what is generally available in the trade press regarding Intel's roadmap, and let's put it this way, anything I may know that is not in the public domain, I can't disclose. But it is a matter of public record that there have been some delays affecting the rollout of, in particular, this type of the Aster King products that directly relate to our revenue opportunities. And to your point, this will have an impact with respect to the milestone that we have set. It is an unfortunate development. There's really nothing we can do about it beyond that which we've been doing all along, which is to endeavor to bring more new products to market targeted at diversifying our customer base and our opportunity base across different kinds of end applications. The impact should not be all that substantial. I think, though, it will change the quarter in which we expected to get to a particular target revenue level by a quarter and a half, relative to the expectations that we had, let's say, at this time last year. Hello?
And fourth quarter booking levels, or some comment about that, of when you would start seeing some of that impact?
Well, I think I generally characterized a breakout revenue level to correspond to an annual rate that the company is not achieved in the past. And so you can infer from our revenue history what that quarterly level would be. I'm not going to be more specific than that. But as I characterized in the past, we are looking forward to the day coming relatively soon, but not as soon as we thought before the delays were referenced in the earlier conversation, when the new applications that we've been pursuing will enable the company with a more diversified customer base to get to levels of revenue that we've not seen before, and which should set a foundation for significant further growth.
Thank you.
The next question comes from the line of Don McKenna. Please proceed.
Patricio, I'm following up on that same line of thinking and going back to the tripling of revenues in that five-year period, and obviously that's never going to be a straight line, and we're probably now 2 to 2.5 years into that goal, and revenues are pretty much flat, I think, with where we started. Obviously now a lot of the products have come on out. When they finally do grasp and take hold and people are really starting to increase those orders, do you still see that five-year goal as a potential target, or is it moved out by 1 or 2 years?
Well, there have been delays, and, you know, I think to lay it on the table, with respect to product development, given the nature of products, given how disruptive the technology is, how advanced it is, how far superior than competitive technology it is, you know, by its measure, the business of pinpointing the availability dates of what I think I can really conservatively characterize as evolutionary products has historically been not as predictable as we all like it to be. But that being the case, the good news is that our track record of new client transactions over the last year proves that we are beyond that phase. And I made this point in earlier calls. We're past the fundamental invention and the technology revolution phase, and we are well into the engineering for additional product flavors, which is a much more predictable endeavor. It is not in the realm of science. It is more in the realm of the kind of engineering that lends itself to very predictable timelines. And that's what we've been able to achieve. The products that come to fruition over the last 6-9 months proved that. I'll give you an example. We had for quite some time a great deal of difficulty bringing the first DCM chip to fruition. The last time I checked, we had released mass production around 40 different flavors of DCM chips in different packages. So that in and of itself speaks volumes to the changing nature of the challenge. It's gone from having to make fundamental strides with challenging technical difficulties to be overcome to a more repetitive, more predictable, more leveraged process of now generating a lot of different flavors of product to address the breadth of the market opportunities in the markets we're targeting. So we are in this new phase. We have already started the seeding process. We're not starting today. This process has been ongoing. We track design wins for products that have been introduced, and those design wins show us tremendous progress with respect to product that is in the pipeline that is being designed in. We design wins that are aggregating the cumulative level of projected revenues that are increasing at an essentially exponential rate. And at this point, it's a matter of converting this work into that which we're particularly interested in these goals, which is financial performance. And frankly, from my perspective, it is not a matter of if, it's a matter of time. Unfortunately, it's taken longer, but we're now in a different phase, and as I look at 2016, I'm very optimistic about what we're going to be able to accomplish.
Thank you. And could I follow up with another question, too, and that would be the, there's been obviously a significant drop in the value of the stock, and the volume has increased substantially for a period of time to the point where it looked like one of your major holders probably said that they were going elsewhere. Have you identified who that might have been?
I frankly don't spend any time worrying about such matters, I don't know if Jamie does. Do you?
I do, but I'm not going to comment on it.
Okay.
Sorry, Don.
That's all right. They'll report it in a couple of weeks anyway. Thank you. I'll get back in line.
Thank you.
The next question comes from the line of John Dillon. Please proceed.
Hi, Patrizio. It sounds like from previous discussions on conference calls and in the annual meeting, you've got one data center now. Is that correct, that taking production quantities of your SIP and chip solution?
I'm not going to make specific comments about, how many. And, I think beyond the comments we made earlier, which is, we are in ongoing production with respect to VR 12.5, and we progressed to 12.5 from VR 12. We're getting ready to ramp the VR 13 as soon as the server chips are ready to ship in mass production. And as discussed in the past, we are very focused on diversifying the customer base expanding our reach, not just in the center space, but in high-end computing and other possible opportunities for our devices. We are seeing a growing migration to 48 volt, which is at the heart of our value proposition. This is something that is resonating with more and more customers that are manufacturing their own data centers, and for a variety of reasons are viewing 48 volt factorized power solutions as something can deliver better performance with lower total ownership costs. I see this as an expanding trend. We're seeing it from a number of different directions with customers and potential customers.
Okay, and it sounds like the current customer or customers plan to continue to take the VR 12.5 solution throughout the first half of next year. Is that what I heard in the prepared remarks?
Yes, so I think you can logically infer that to the extent that there have been delays with respect to more powerful processors, customers that have a need for additional capabilities will continue to avail themselves of the existing solution, even though anticipating the benefits of a next generation solution, I think we can all logically surmise that they are going to be very conservative with respect to how much incremental capacity they deploy, since that capacity would be, in effect, technologically superseded before too long by the next generation solution. So there's going to be ongoing demand. But as suggested in the prepared remarks, that demand is going to be at reduced levels, and we are in the midst of that now. That demand for VR 12.5 solutions will, however, continue to be there and overlap with the ramp in VR 13 solutions as soon as that begins. And at that time, there's going to be a combination of some remaining level of business with 12.5 and a rapidly ramping the R13 bit.
Okay, good. So we won't see the drop. Like, I remember when we went from the VI chip solution to the 12.5, we saw a really steep dip in Vicor's
book. Well, so, we've been now through a couple of cycles, and frankly, we've learned from these experiences. We learned how these demand cycles evolve, and we are better equipped at dealing with them in a way that addresses the customer needs without creating risk of obsolete inventory or other kinds of issues, even though, frankly, we have right now a capacity underutilization issue that we're only going to be able to address as demand steps up again.
Great, okay. And talking of which, you mentioned you're going to be reallocating space, I think, in your Andover to beef up your production. Can you give us a little more color on that? How much are you going to be prepared for the 2013 orders that you're expecting, and are you going to be able to How much are you going to build out in Andover?
We're about to spend several million dollars to put in place initial capacity for automatic capacity for VR products. We got some design wins. Some are potentially very significant, and we want to be sure to be ahead of the demand curve. And have more than adequate capacity in place ahead of that curve. So that's also a 2016 event. And so the second half of this year is characterized in terms of operational preparations by investing a good deal of focus and resources in this additional capacity. You know, while also continuing to expand our capabilities at the point of load. To be clear, this is not a case of one capability at the expense of the other. They're really very cohesive developments that support one another, at least in some applications, and in other ways do not directly interfere with one another in that we are pursuing both with the requisite level of focus.
You mentioned before in previous calls how there's two new data centers that you've got on design wins for, and I'm wondering, are you still making progress with them on the memory rails, and also are these tier one data center customers?
So I'm not going to, again, be very specific with respect to the customers. As discussed before, we're making very good progress with expanding our footprint outside of just addressing the processor rail. We got design wins that involve other parts of the system, and we are expanding our footprint in different ways depending on the particular customer and application.
I'll get back in the queue. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The next question comes from the line of Mr. Feldman. Please proceed.
Patricio, could you comment on two things? One, how do you see your efforts in penetrating the ever-growing use of electronics in the automobile industry?
Okay, on the automotive front, we have some design wins. They're not very high volume, but it's the first step. They're primarily in Asia. We, as I mentioned in the past, have been working on products for the automotive market that will advance our figure of merit substantially, both by taking the efficiency to unprecedented levels, taking the density far beyond that of our initial product, while at the same time cutting our cents per watt cost metric way down. I expect that we're going to start seeing opportunities with these products within the next 6 months. Now, there's going to be, again, unfortunately, a relatively long gestation period in terms of customer engagement and design cycles, but we already have customers that have had some level of exposure to our roadmap product and these more advanced capabilities and have expressed great interest in them as soon as they're available, and we're working very hard to bring them to fruition as soon as possible, and we're getting very close.
Is this so, in electric vehicles and hybrid vehicles, or in more standardized autos?
All of the above, and before too long, I see also opportunity in terms of solar utility type of applications. That's an emerging market that is very much related to developments with electric vehicles and other such things. So our core competencies in terms of power components with very high efficiency, very high density, and of late, a great deal of cost effectiveness and scalability and flexibility, they all play well to the kinds of needs of those markets. So the implementation of the technology that we've had today with, in particular, our very first DCM, and I was referencing it implicitly in the earlier remarks, that initial capability is attractive because of some of its attributes, in particular the fact that these products offer a very good efficiency under all operating range, meaning from heavy loads to very light loads. But in other respects, they are not as efficient, as dense, and as cost-effective as our technology enables. But that step up in performance and cost-effectiveness is coming to closure, and I think that's going to be key to getting us, you know, with a little foot in the door at tier three accounts to having potentially a much more significant play in the automotive electronics market, which, as we discussed in the past, tends to drive a lot of spenders. There's a great deal of interplay and potential, commonality between what is good for automotive and what is good for other mainstream electronic markets, particularly with a view to the power component methodology that we advocate.
Changing topics, I wonder if you could give us an update on the legal status of where things stand with Supreme Court.
Well, I think that the bulk of our effort, in particular the defense effort, is behind us. You know, we've already essentially invalidated two of their patents. We got two left to go, and we're very focused on accomplishing that. And then moving on with our counterclaims, which still stand.
Is there any timetable?
Well, the timetable has been delayed because of a variety of things, including of late federal developments for us at the level of the Federal Circuit and in the Patent Office. So we obviously are still very focused on that, but I think from a shareholder's perspective, I would view that threat as not being any longer of any significance and potentially having an upside for it.
Okay. Thank you for taking my question.
Thank you.
We have a follow-up question from Don McKenna. Please proceed.
Patricia, could you talk a bit about Mouser? Is that a kind of an add-on or is it an upgrade from the two distributors they had? And what areas do they cover that the other guys didn't? And are they considered top tier?
Mouser is a world-renowned distributor. It has complementary capabilities in terms of the kinds of customers that it services. Like DigiKey, it is potentially very leveraged in terms of expanding our customer base, providing us with greater breadth, greater exposure in the marketplace. It is a go-to distributor for a lot of customers, just like DigiKey is. It has complementary capabilities that should result in an expansion of our reach.
When they indicated they had product available to ship from their inventory, is that product still owned by Vicor, or did you already sold it to them?
Jenny, do you want to comment on our conservative accounting practices?
Mouser is our third docking distributor. Yeah. And under the arrangements with stocking distributors is that we do, in fact, sell the product to, in this case, Mauser. But there are certain stock rotation and return privileges that a stocking distributor has. So that's where the you see the line item on our balance sheet now, you see deferred revenue. We only recognize the revenue when, in this case, Mauser tells us that they have themselves sold it onto their customer.
Okay. So in looking at the revenue numbers for the second quarter, they don't none of that represents stocking, if you will, at Mauser.
Correct, because that wouldn't be recognized.
Thank you.
It's only a sale after the distributor sells the product to third-party customers.
And do they cover different territories?
That's the expectation. That's their complement to DigiKey.
Well, so I think part of it is territory, part of it is in markets and customers. It's not necessarily a case of it being complementary by geography, even though geography plays a role with respect.
Sure. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
The next question is from Alana, John Dillon. Please proceed.
Yes. Patricia, in the prepared remarks, you said something to the effect of expanded share of the VR13 market. Can you expand upon that a little bit? What does that mean? Or give me a little more clarity on that?
Well, I think what it comes down to is the fact that our VR13, that we have a VR13 multiplier, if you will, at a level considerably above the VR12.5, which in turn was above 12. But we expect with VR13 to have a much more significant step up in revenues that are derived from powering rails that relate to the VR13 type processor.
Does this also mean you've got additional new design wins in that market?
Yes, I think we talked about this earlier. So it's a combination of customers and footprint within a customer expanding beyond a particular rail.
Okay. And, again, in the remarks, prepared remarks, something to the effect that the design wins are leading to exponential growth. What exactly does that mean, or did I hear that correctly?
Well, so as I look, for instance, at design wins we already have had for the PFM registration that have been added up in recent times, you know, since the corresponding prior introduction, and registrations that have taken place with respect to the DCM products that, you know, have been released in chip form, you know, earlier this year. We are seeing these registrations adding up at a fast pace, you know, from week to week, month to month, and, you know, it's been a couple of quarters, but over that time frame. It is the start of something that for that portion of our product line is very exciting because it suggests that, number one, the product is attractive to a range of customers and that, you know, they are, in effect, taking it to the next stage in terms of, you know, ordering sample quantities, in some cases ordering initial, you know, small quantity production, which is stepping stone to larger future quantities. We are in that phase, and with some of these products, the CMs in particular, in chip form, we've already seen double-digit millions of dollars in the low teens worth of registrations that should lead to future business.
And this exponential growth, is this all 2016 growth? And
well, I think this has got, as discussed in the past, the characteristic cycle time, gestation time of the kinds of industrial products, OEM products that we make. So a typical lead time would be, I would say, 12, 18 months. Now, as discussed in the past, one of the differentiating attributes of our new VIA products, for which we've had some initial introductions that you might have seen announced in press releases, and with respect to which you're going to see a lot more introductions you know, coming in weeks and months to come. Those products have a shorter time to fruition because they don't require the customer to design the solution on their motherboard. These are products that typically are used as you know, front-end components, get mounted to a chassis, and because of that, they tend to get designed in later in the cycle, in the customer cycle. And occasionally there's an opportunity because of changing power requirements or issues the customer might have with the solution that they plan to use, which may not work or may not have enough power capability, that there's an opportunity for, in effect, substituting something else. So the characteristic time scale for those kinds of products tends to be shorter, and they could provide a contribution on a shorter time scale than, let's say, you know, PRM, VTM, point of load, factorized power solution, whose typical design cycle is a lot longer because the customer is fundamentally adapting to, you know, a power distribution architecture that is unique, it's novel, it's got a significant design impact.
Yeah, I was in an AT&T telecommunications center the other day, and I saw the 48-volt distribution, and it looked like there's a lot of areas that Vicor could play in there. But in particular, what really stuck out to me was on the back of a Juniper router was a silver box. It was actually four silver boxes, which were 48-volt, you know, power supply systems, redundant systems. Is that the type of market you're going after, and are you making progress in those types of markets?
The communications applications are, you know, part of our target for these kinds of products. To your point, there's a lot of those boxes in communication systems. They tend to be relatively fragmented type of opportunities that with conventional approaches are challenged because of you know, the lack of scalability. I mean, the box or boxes that you saw very likely were designed as traditional custom power supplies by Asian vendors that are challenged with respect to an ROI proposition on these kinds of boxes because, frankly, of any one of them, there may only be, you know, let's say $2 million, $5 million a year worth of business opportunity, which makes it difficult to justify developing the solution from the ground up, you know, with the engineering team that has to be focused on making the development happen on a time scale of 9 or 12 months. You know, with our VIA approach, we have a level of scalability to address these kinds of needs that changes the ROI calculation and changes some of the basic criteria for success. And I think over time is going to give us a lot of traction in these kinds of applications.
So, for example, the power distribution boxes that I saw all over the place, were they potential customers? Were they buy your DCMs or other products and use those for 48-volt distribution?
That's a possibility. Yeah, that's part of the market opportunity.
Yeah, it looked like pretty...
In the aggregate, this is a very large market. If you look at an individual box, the revenue opportunity for any one individual box typically is not all that large. Hence, the approach that in the long term will win, in my opinion, is one that doesn't go at it on a case-by-case basis, you know, with an army of engineers. That's not scalable. We have a scalable approach.
You have a building block approach that can solve these problems.
In a much more efficient and reliable way, because part of the proposition, part of the value proposition is that customers can, in effect, reuse proven building blocks.
Yeah. I mean, it looked like a nice market for you, because that Juniper, they had a big, ugly silver box on the back. And I guess the other question, are you going to be building silver boxes for these customers?
Well, our focus is going to be on addressing the power system requirement with solutions that, to the extent possible, are standard or semi-custom type of solutions as opposed to a custom tailored solution, which, you know, for the reasons I outlined a moment ago, you know, tend to be very challenged.
Right, I understand.
Because of lack of space, because of the fact that they're squeezed in terms of the power needs and the volume that is available to address the power need, they're often tempted to want to have something designed to just fit in the leftover space. But again, for the reasons that you know were quickly outlined a little while ago, that's not an attractive proposition either for the customers because of the near cost, delays, risks, or even for their suppliers because with the traditional way of doing that kind of a solution from the ground up, there is really no return on investment.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
Well, if there is the last question, if not, is there any other question, operator?
The next question comes from the line of Jeff Cohn. Please proceed.
Patricio, given the stock decline and the company's outlook for growth, do you have any plans for investor relations in any way, non-deal roadshow or conferences, or what's your thinking on investor relations?
My thinking is that we still need to stay focused on delivering the goods with respect to delivering the products, and we've been doing a good job of that. And now delivering the revenues, and you know, as you know from the early discussion, we still have a few quarters of work to do to be able to present to investors, you know, a very appealing success story. And that would be a better time to take our case to investors. Right now, we need to stay focused on delivering the goods.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. And with that, we'll reset for the next quarterly call. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation in today's conference. That concludes the presentation. You may now disconnect. Have a great day.